Hello, and welcome to the Net Politics Podcast. I'm Karen Kornblue, the Senior Fellow for Digital Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're very lucky to have with us today Peter Swire. Peter is a well-known expert on privacy and cybersecurity. He's professor of law at Georgia Tech. Welcome, Peter.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's a great time to have you here. We have a lot of questions. I'll give Peter's very brief current bio, but then we'll go back and talk about how he got to be the expert that he is. Peter is the Huang Professor of Law and Ethics at the Georgia Tech Schellers College of Business. He's also senior counsel with the law firm Alston & Byrd. He served as one of five members of the White House Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technology. Peter's also a senior fellow with the Future of Privacy Forum. He was special assistant to President Obama for economic policy. And in 2015, the International Association of Privacy Professionals honored him with the Privacy Leadership Award. So, Peter, take us back in time. What had you done before President Obama was elected, and how did you wind up as this special assistant for economic policy working on privacy issues?
Well, thanks, Karen. My background on privacy and internet law goes back almost to prehistory. I wrote my first article on internet law, cyberspace, in 1993. And in the late 90s, I wrote a book for the Brookings Institution with Robert Lighton on U.S. and EU and how to handle the data protection and privacy issues. And it was really that book that led me to be asked to come into the Clinton White House at the end of 1998. I was called the Chief Counselor for Privacy. And that was a busy period on privacy. We negotiated the safe harbor with Europe. There was a big encryption change in 1999 to allow export of strong encryption. And I chaired the White House process for the HIPAA medical privacy rule, among other things. So the late 90s, the internet bubble, there was a lot of privacy and cybersecurity things going on. And I came out of that, and I think people thought of me as someone who had experience on the privacy and privacy policy side of things.
And I would caution you not to call it bubble. I have issues with that because I think it was a bubble maybe in the way that the railroad bubble was a bubble and that we wound up with a lot of great infrastructure built.
Fair enough. Lots of investment in the field, and that investment paid dividends in later years.
Exactly. That's what I think. So tell us what you did in the Obama White House. What were some of the accomplishments on privacy?
Well, in 2009 and 10, frankly, privacy wasn't as big as the financial crisis. And so I was working for Larry Summers on economic policy. And most of my time at that period was really working on the financial crisis and housing policy. I went back to my early days as a banking law regulator and lawyer. I think that the extra privacy stuff and surveillance stuff happened more after Snowden.
Mm-hmm.
So in June of 2013, Snowden began releasing the stories that got in the paper about the PRISM program and the Section 215 telephone database. And in August, President Obama named this five-person review group to provide advice to him about what to do in the wake of the Snowden controversies. And we had quite a good group. Richard Clark is a cybersecurity expert. Michael Morell had been number two at the CIA. Cass Sunstein's a famous law professor and government official, and Jeffrey Stone had been dean at the University of Chicago. So I was included in that group, which I felt very honored to do, and we did this big 300-page book, basically, on what to do next.
And you were out of the government by this point.
At that point, I was out of the government. I came to Georgia Tech on August 1st. I got married on August 2nd, and the White House called on August 5th, even before we'd moved into our house. So that was one crazy week.
Quite a honeymoon.
Yeah.
So you know, there are a number of people who are wondering, who follow these things from a distance and feel that there's been this buildup of the surveillance state that Snowden warned about. And now we have a president-elect Trump who's going to come in, and people are concerned that if he's less cautious, perhaps, than President Obama might be, that we'd have what Snowden called turnkey tyrant or turnkey tyranny. I mean, talk to us a little bit about the reforms that have been put in place since the Snowden revelations, what has been done, what hasn't been done from your report, and how easy would it be to undo those or to really use the tools of surveillance to be more invasive.
A powerful president can do all sorts of things, but we also have a lot of checks and balances. We've had this constitution going in our country for well over two centuries now. We have courts, we have laws, and we actually made an impressive set of reforms since 2013. I did some testimony last year in December for the European privacy authorities that listed 24 different reforms that were made between 2013 and the end of last year, and we've done some more since then. A lot of those are statutes. So Congress went and passed something called the USA Freedom Act that in a lot of ways was a correction for some of the problems from the USA Patriot Act that we created in 2001. And USA Freedom Act does some things like this. It says that for the secret FISA court that oversees these wiretaps, that there's going to be privacy and civil liberty experts actually writing briefs as amicus to the court on the important cases now. So instead of just the Justice Department giving their side of the story, we're going to have briefing from the privacy and civil liberty side as well. Another reform is that we know it's a problem to have secret law. So now if the FISA court goes and changes its interpretation of law or makes an important new announcement, the statute says that the court has to publish as much of the opinion as it can, and at a minimum it has to publish a summary of how the law has changed. So that concern about secret law that's secretly authorizing things, we have a really good statutory provision that orders the court to do this. And those courts are independent Article III lifetime tenured federal judges. So I think that's a really powerful check on abuses in the intelligence system. There are a series of other reforms around what you might call transparency. So until this law last year, the companies had important limits on how much they could report. But now the companies, Google or Facebook or other service providers, have the ability and they have the practice of giving fairly detailed statements of how many different kinds of orders under different legal authorities they're responding to from the United States government. And you can cross-check those with some required reports by the United States government that includes how many individuals have been targeted. And those reports, the statistical reports that we've seen in the last couple of years, are quite comforting. So instead of Section 702, the PRISM program and the Epstein program, instead of these surveilling everybody, the total number of individuals targeted out of 7 billion people in the world was around 90,000 targets. That's a bunch of people. We have a surveillance, authorities under law that exists. But 90,000 is not mass and indiscriminate surveillance of everybody. It's more a targeted effort where we have a reason to think there's some reason to look for what's going on in those places. So those are some of the reforms, and those are statutory reforms. It would take a new law from Congress to change those. And it's hard to pass laws through the House and through the Senate and to have the president sign it. So, if we see changes in the law, we'll see it coming. Everyone will get to participate and state their views on it. But those are statutory changes that exist no matter who's president now.
Are there things that concern you about what's left, what hasn't been reformed?
Well, sure. There's one topic, the Section 702. This is where you target somebody overseas, but you might incidentally collect data about U.S. persons and about other people who aren't targeted. That sunsets at the end of this coming year, at the end of 2017. So if Congress doesn't pass a law, then the United States government will lose the ability to do these kinds of wiretaps. Now, our group, when we did our report, found that Section 702 was a useful program, that it had some changes that should be made so that it's not used as a sort of backdoor way to spy on Americans. And so I would favor reforms, pro-privacy reforms to Section 702. That might be harder to get with the current lineup in Congress. We'll see. But that will be a public debate in 2017, and it means that something almost for sure will pass the Congress around Section 702. That also creates the opportunity to pass some other things that Republicans and Democrats and companies and civil liberties people have been working for, like email privacy, where you only have probable cause to read somebody's email. So I think these issues will be in Congress next year. There's been a lot of members who've been voting on the privacy side for the last few years, and we'll see if they keep voting that way. Mm-hmm. But if they do, we have a chance to have some good reforms.
That's fascinating. It's really interesting. So how does this play out with Europe? Europe is watching us. Europe is concerned. This privacy shield was tough to negotiate. How do you see things playing out with the privacy shield, but also the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, and the e-privacy rewrite that they're doing? Mm-hmm. If you're over in Europe, there's a lot going on over there, but they're concerned about the effect of our big companies there.
Sure. Well, I was just in Belgium and France for conferences recently on these topics and talked to a lot of the European officials. Europe has had for 20 years now stricter privacy rules in the private sector. That was the directive that they passed in 1995. And our safe harbor was a way to deal with that. That's getting even stricter for this general data protection regulation that kicks in early 2018. So there's a gap in regulation between Europe being stricter and the U.S. not as strict. That gap has been filled pretty well by the agreement from the EU Commission and from the United States government to do the privacy shield. and to have the safeguards and the privacy shield apply to other mechanisms such as what are called standard contract clauses. So we have a bunch of legal things established that I think, you know, are quite promising and should work well. One of the problems or one of the risks to that is litigation. So there was litigation by a sort of civil liberties activist named Max Schrems against Facebook that came up to the top court, the European Court of Justice, in 2015. And they said they were worried enough about U.S. surveillance in the United States that maybe it wasn't going to be okay to ship data from Europe to the United States because they're afraid too much surveillance and NSA stuff when it got to the U.S. The follow-on case is happening right now in Ireland. Max Schrems is suing Facebook on these standard contract clauses. And there's going to be a trial that's scheduled for February. Very detailed briefings have been done to the court. They have a much, much larger factual record this time than they had previously. And so the Irish court, and then maybe up on appeal to the European Court of Justice, they're going to have to decide in detail whether the U.S. surveillance system, the oversight, the safeguards, essentially are good enough that it's okay to send data from personal data from Europe to the United States. So we'll see how that litigation plays out. I've written in my testimony last year in December why I think the U.S. system is actually stronger than the European system in many respects. There's a well-known British expert named Ian Brown from Oxford who came to the same conclusion in a big study he did. So, you know, hopefully the courts will decide that there are strong enough safeguards in the United States. If they don't, they could find that a lot of transfers of data are illegal under European law as a matter of their constitutional law, their fundamental rights law. And if that happens, it's not clear how people will operate. If you just decide the U.S. has too much surveillance, will Europe really cut off all those data flows to the United States? It could be quite a big story, worth a lot more podcasts if that really happens over the next year or two.
Say again when the decision's going to come?
Well, according to the public reports, the trial in Ireland will be in February, a couple months. They would do the trial, the Irish court would reach its decision, and then that potentially would go up on appeal to the European Court of Justice, you know, so who knows, maybe a year from February, very roughly speaking, we might see the outcome of that litigation.
That's very interesting. That'll be hanging over all of our heads. Tell us about, you helped me. I was writing a cyber brief, and I leaned pretty heavily on your scholarship. And one of the things that you've written about and talked about is mutual legal assistance reform. This is a really technical issue. It's something that actually, when CFR had a task force on digital policy a few years ago, they called for reform of mutual legal assistance treaties. It's a very technical, complicated issue. Maybe you could simplify it for us and tell us why it's important.
Well, I've been working on this for a couple of years now intensively. We have several law review articles on it. I think I can now say it almost in English, so I'm going to give that a try. So the starting point is what you might call the globalization of data. I think we just know that our emails and our social network posts are often stored in other countries. So evidence about what happened in the United States might be in Europe. Evidence of what happened in Europe might be in the United States. That means if there's a criminal investigation, instead of just getting local information from a local company, the police suddenly have an international incident. They might have to go to their national authority, who goes to the U.S. Department of Justice, who goes to the Northern District of California, who asks the company for the evidence. And it's even harder than that for police because encryption matters. So in the old days, they had things called wiretaps. If you had a suspect, you might want to get a wiretap on their communications. But today, our emails and a lot of the other things we do, our Facebook posts, are actually encrypted from the time it leaves my house till the time it gets to the destination, or at least until it gets to the server.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a wiretap on my house can't read my emails anymore, can't read my web traffic anymore. So the local police can't do a local wiretap, and the evidence is stored overseas. And so the local police are facing a big problem. And the volume of international incidents is going way up high because of this. So the research project, and we're supported by the Hewlett Foundation, and there's other people working on this. The research project is how do we update this global evidence for the digital age we're living in. And we've suggested some ways where you can do it by statute, we can do some streamlining of the situation, but you want to do it in a way that still protects privacy and civil liberties because you don't want every country in the world grabbing all the evidence. And so somehow you streamline it and you have some privacy safeguards in place. And so we've been trying to work up overall systems for doing both of those things.
Tell us about why it's important in the overall scheme of things. You know, when we hear about hacking into Apple phones and needing back doors, how do these things connect? Because I think you've got a great way of thinking about it.
So around the mutual legal assistance, the challenge is going to be that regular law enforcement, regular criminal investigations could get stymied. And that means bad guys can get away. And so having a better system for cooperating between the governments is part of it. On the other hand, it's a bad idea, in my view, to go breaking the encryption just to help wiretaps be easier. There's some language in the recent UK law that suggests that that might be the British law. It's hard to tell. And so I've written a lot on the encryption side about what FBI Director Comey and others have called going dark, which is the idea that, oh my goodness, law enforcement can't see things, and have written about what I call instead the golden age of surveillance, that actually if you're the FBI today, you have things like location information from people's cell phones. You have the metadata of everybody I've connected with through emails and texts and social networks. That shows who my co-conspirators and my colleagues are. There's lots of other databases that all the privacy people worry about. There's a lot of cameras everywhere if you do a crime in person on the streets. So Tim Cook picked up on this golden age of surveillance in his Time magazine interview last year, the cover story. And it's a way to talk back to the law enforcement when they say going dark is the big problem, because it's not dark. It's actually lit up in a way that it never has been for law enforcement. At the same time, certain categories of evidence can be hard to get. And so we should try to figure out when those categories have met the right standard, how the police can get legitimate access to it without breaking the technical infrastructure.
Is the problem with reform, in your mind, coming up with an intellectual answer that balances privacy, civil liberties against streamlining, or is it just resources and will?
I think it's more than resources and will, because if you go up by a factor of 10 or 100, it doesn't scale to just have more paralegals checking every document. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to do that. And it's going to be from all the rest of the world. It's going to be from India. It's going to be from lots of places. So I think, you know, maybe this is, when I'm not in government, I'm a professor, so maybe it's the professor in me, and I'll plead guilty to that. But we've been trying to come up with an intellectual structure that basically says, we have a model that we've used in another place for globalization. It used to be people stayed in their own country and didn't travel on vacation to other countries very often. And in those days, you had to get a visa and go to the consulate and do an interview if you wanted to travel. But now we have something called the Visa Waiver Program. People travel back and forth to Europe, or they come to Disneyland in the United States. And so we make it automatic, not for everybody. You don't get an automatic visa from war-torn Syria. But for 38 countries that have a good enough set of standards in place, the United States has a visa waiver. And so the countries who decide to tighten their systems, do it right, have the right safeguards, are able to have their citizens go back and forth to the United States. And so we've compared the visa waiver program to what we should do with this law enforcement assistance and say that other countries who have a good enough system, like the visa waiver system, should be able to get the data automatically or almost automatically. And I think that shows how we've dealt with globalization in another important setting, and it gives us an intellectual model that can help us think through this sharing of law enforcement data.
Let me ask you, you know, in a lot of other globalization questions, we go to these international organizations, or the Obama administration supported creation or elevation of the G20. Mm-hmm. And the G20 hasn't really dealt with digital issues until maybe the last year in mm-hmm. any major way. Is there a place for resolving or discussing any subset of these issues, do you think? Because these have become, these shouldn't be so siloed, it seems to me. They're at the heart of economics, of security, and so on.
Well, I mean, you've been a leader. You were at the OECD as ambassador, so you have a view of the real capabilities of international organizations. You know, my guess is some of them are ones that I tend to be more favorable to than others. Mm-hmm. A lot of the American tech community is pretty skeptical of the International Telecommunications Union if it tries to expand
Absolutely.
Too far into the Internet. Mm-hmm. So just saying it's international doesn't tell you whether it's a good or bad answer. You have to look at who's doing it and what the institutional incentives are and the history of each organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I think on the sharing of evidence for criminal things, I think you tend to start with some examples. So the United States and the United Kingdom have draft legislation that I think is in the ballpark for supporting. I don't agree with every detail of it, but I think it's a pretty good model. And I'm also writing, we've been doing work with India to try to figure out how a different legal system could fit with what we're saying. I think that the goal is to have some good examples, see how they work, and build out from there. It could be that once you've had a couple of good examples, the G20 or whatever your other favorite group is, might be better able to adopt it. But I think that the first experiments probably happen a different way. They happen with more bilateral sort of experts involved, civil society involved kinds of discussions. You try to get some things that work, and then you try to scale those.
The thing that we were thinking about, as you recall, in the cyber brief was, since this could hamper free flow of information, if that's a goal that you have, how do you put some pressure behind figuring out some reforms? Tell me, what else do you think about over the horizon, and then we'll let you go. What are the other, I mean, you've laid out a lot of big ones.
Besides encryption, US-EU data, and the future of criminal procedure.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything we've missed?
Well, I think that there's a lot that fit together. President Obama has this cybersecurity commission, I've heard the report's going to come out this Friday. I'm speaking now the week after Thanksgiving, so they're going to have their report, and cybersecurity is super important. You have to do cybersecurity to protect your systems, and you have to share data when it's the right time to share it, but not the time that's going to blow everybody's privacy. So how do you get the security and the defense without that becoming an excuse to look at everybody and surveil them all the time? I think that's a hard challenge. One other hard challenge is the Internet of Things. We've seen now that denial of service attacks can, as long people had long predicted, and denial of service attacks can come from Internet of Things. Many of them are very badly secured. The incentives on the manufacturers are very weak. And so as we go to this next generation, this next scaling up of Internet-enabled devices, I think we're going to need a much bigger push on security for the Internet of Things, or else we're just going to be recreating vulnerabilities on a huge scale. So those are some of the other things we've been working on.
Great. Thank you, Peter. We have a lot more to discuss. I hope when you're in D.C., you'll think about doing a roundtable.
Okay.
We'd love to have you here.
I love the idea.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Karen.